Welcome to the Issue Is podcast. I'm Alex Michelson. This week, the big issue we're looking at is world affairs, something we don't get to do enough of here. And we actually go to the White House to talk to John Kirby, who is with the National Security Council. He's been in like 1,000 jobs. We saw him as the Pentagon spokesperson. We saw him as a spokesperson for the State Department years ago. He joined the military in 1986. And he's one of the best spokespeople in all of Washington, which is why he keeps getting hired. So it was really fascinating to talk to him for the first time. A little later, we'll talk to Seema Mehta about Ron DeSantis coming to California. But let's begin with Kirby. We talk about Ukraine and China. We also talk about him and get personal and learn something about him and his family's deep commitment to the military. So here is John Kirby. With us from the White House is John Kirby. He is the National Security Council Coordinator for Strategic Communications at the White House, which is one of the longest titles in Washington history. Translation, he's a big deal. He's been serving our country for decades. Welcome to The Issue Is for the first time, and thank you for your service.
Well, good to be with you, Alex. I'm looking forward to this.
All right, so we are more than a year into the war. And sort of the big question is, what is the State of the Union of Ukraine? Where are we at? And what is that extra money that we're now sending they're going to do?
Well, we have been trying to support Ukraine in the battlefield here since the beginning of the war. And the package that we announced today is just the most recent one. And what this package today will do, will give them some additional rockets and artillery shells, ammunition that they need for the fighting in the weeks and months ahead. It's been a brutal year, obviously, for the Ukrainian people. But when you look at what they've been able to accomplish in that year, recovering more than 50% of the territory that Russia took in the first weeks and months of this war, the Ukrainians have won it back. And they expect that there's going to be heavy fighting here in the spring when the weather gets better. And we want to make sure that they're ready for that.
Yeah, the president meeting with the German chancellor this week. Do you think that Europe is paying its fair share in all this?
Europe has contributed mightily to the effort to support Ukraine. First of all, our NATO allies have really stood strong together to shore up that eastern flank of the alliance, and all of them, in one way or another, are contributing to support to Ukraine independently of the alliance, of course. But there's terrific solidarity across the continent. The president last week, as you noted, was in Poland. He was in Kyiv to meet with President Zelensky, and he came away from that trip convinced that allied unity remains resolute, remains determined. We're going to need it to be as we face difficult weeks and months ahead.
You know, you've heard from critics. There are folks who say, look, we feel for the people of Ukraine, but we've got, for example, thousands of homeless on the streets of California. We can't afford to take care of our own people. Why are we spending so much money in another country? What do you say to those people?
I think when you look at what's happening in Ukraine, there's a couple of things. Number one, it's the very idea of independence, Alex, and that's something that all Americans can get behind. We all understand what it's like to have to fight for your independence, to fight for the very existence to be a country. That's what's facing the Ukrainian people right now. So that's an ideal that all of us Americans understand. Number two, this war has absolutely had an effect on the American people. If you look at the price of gas, if you look at inflation, this war has contributed to cost prices around the world. Not that that is by any measure the most extreme consequence of this war. The most extreme consequence is the slaughter of innocent Ukrainian men, women, and children, as well as millions being flung into refuge. And then the last thing I'd say is, and I think the American people understand this, that if we just walk away from this, if we just say that's it, and we let Putin take all of Ukraine, where does it end? What's next? And I can guarantee you that if he just gets away with this, the cost in blood and treasure, not just to the United States and Americans, but to so many of our allies and partners, will be exorbitantly much higher than the cost that has been expended to keep Ukraine in the fight and to keep them in that fight successfully.
But to that point also, what is the end game in Ukraine? Is there an end date for our involvement? Some people are spooked by the thought of, like, Afghanistan. We're there for 20 years and have to walk away.
Today could be that date. If Mr. Putin would do the right thing and pull his troops out of Ukraine, where they have no business being in the first place. Now, clearly, he shows no signs of being willing to do that. So we got to make sure that we continue to support Ukraine, make sure they're successful on the battlefield, so that if and when President Zelensky is ready to sit down and negotiate, that he can do so from a position of strength. We'd all like to see this war end as soon as possible. And the Ukrainians, no less of anybody, wants to see it want to see it over. But we've got to make sure that we put President Zelensky and the Ukrainians in the best position possible.
So, I mean, is that sort of an indefinite commitment?
Nobody knows how long this war is going to go on. I'd be foolish if I tried to give you a date certain, Alex, or give you a target. We all would like to see it end today. We'd all like to see it end as soon as possible. But ultimately, that's going to be up to President Zelensky to determine. And as President Biden has said, as all the G7 leaders have said, we're going to have to stay at this. We're going to have to continue to support Ukraine so that if and when they can get to the negotiating table, President Zelensky can succeed in that the way his troops have been succeeding in the field.
We want to talk about another foreign policy hotspot, which is in some ways related to Ukraine as well, which is China. They've tried to get involved in some of that. There's been controversies over their spy balloon, questions over COVID's origin recently. More broadly, though, how would you describe the state of the U.S. relationship with China right now? Are we in sort of a Cold War?
No, not at all. And there's no reason that it should get to a Cold War sort of environment. We consider our relationship with China, which is, quite frankly, the most consequential bilateral relationship in the world right now, as a strategic competition. And it's a competition that President Biden believes we can win. We've got the innovation, we've got the ingenuity, we've got the industry here in the United States. We can win this competition. We don't seek a conflict with China, and there's no reason for these tensions. And there are tensions in the relationship. You mentioned just a few of them. There's no reasons for those tensions to devolve into some kind of conflict.
You know, some on the right have questioned the U.S.'s stance towards China. Here's Republican presidential candidate Nikki Haley on Fox News Sunday recently.
And it's time for us to stop being reactionary to China and start actually being aggressive and letting China know what we expect of them.
How do you respond to that? And what do we expect of China?
I would encourage anybody who has those kinds of opinions about how we're handling the challenge of China to take a look at what we've done over the last 2 years in this administration. Take a look at our national security strategy, which prioritizes this competition with China. Take a look at our national defense strategy, which calls China the pacing challenge of the Defense Department. Take a look at the additional resources, economic and military, that we've put in the Indo-Pacific. Take a look at the way the president has prioritized our alliances and partnerships, not just in Europe, of course, with the war in Ukraine, but in the Indo-Pacific, where five of our seven treaty alliances reside. Alex, we're confident that we have taken on the China challenge with forethought, with a deliberate policymaking approach, and with a measured approach to managing this strategic competition responsibly. That's where the president wants to be. That's where we've been. And I can assure you that that's where we're going to stay throughout this administration.
Let's talk a moment about you. We see you in the briefing room all the time. You're one of the main faces of the administration. You were first commissioned in the Navy back in 1986. You served 28 years in uniform. You were the Pentagon spokesman. You've served multiple presidents, multiple defense secretaries. What would you say was the biggest challenge of your career, and how did you handle it?
Wow. I don't think I've ever gotten that question before. I think one of the biggest challenges was when I left the Navy and left my first job as Pentagon Press Secretary under then Secretary of Defense Hagel, and went to go work at the State Department under Secretary Kerry in the last 2 years of the Obama administration. There were some things that translated well. I mean, many of the foreign policy things that Secretary Kerry was advancing, I was familiar with, having worked at the Pentagon. But working at the State Department and learning that culture and that institution was a really, I mean, it was a steep learning curve. But I enjoyed every day of it. Secretary Kerry was a terrific boss, and learning the world through the eyes of our diplomats, as opposed to through the eyes of our sailors, soldiers, Marine, and airmen, was a terrific experience. But I'll be honest with you. I mean, it took me a little time to get up to speed.
How would you compare the different presidents you've served?
I don't think I'm going to go into that. I think I would just say that, and I can see it now in this current job that I'm in here at the National Security Council. Being commander in chief is the most weight you can put on an individual's shoulders to make decisions every day that really are life and death decisions, and to see the sobriety, the solemnity, the seriousness with which President Biden approaches those decisions has been quite inspiring for me.
These days, it's a relatively small minority of Americans who actually serve the country in our armed forces. What do you think is the most important lesson that the rest of us can learn from them?
I think we veterans have to do a better job telling our stories, quite frankly. You're right, a very small percentage, because it's an all-volunteer force, have served. And we got to make sure that we don't allow the military to become sort of an insular community, something apart from America. I mean, if you were to go to the Pentagon today with me and you approached, I don't know, 10 different people working there in uniform, I guarantee you that the majority, probably 8 or 9 out of those 10, would tell you that they had a family member who either was serving or have served. My grandfather was on a battleship in World War I. My father was on an aircraft carrier in the 1950s. All my brothers, all 4 of them, all 5 of us, my dad made us join the military, so we all had service. That is a wonderful thing. My son is a naval officer right now, as a matter of fact, on a destroyer. It's a thing that we're very, very proud of. But if we're not careful, it can create a sense of insularity, which is, again, not helpful and not healthy for the Republic, especially when it is an all-volunteer force.
All right, and finally, we're going to end with something fun. This is called Personal Issues, which is 30 seconds of rapid-fire questions of your about your cultural favorites. This is the first thing that comes to mind to get to know you a little bit better. Okay, you ready? You seem very excited. We'll start with this. What is your favorite TV show?
Seinfeld.
Your favorite band or musical artist?
Alan Jackson.
Who is your favorite athlete of all time?
Oof, that's a tough one. I'd say Jack Dempsey, the boxer.
There you go, old school. Favorite book of all time?
Oh, that's easy, The Caine Mutiny by Herman Wouk. I think it's a terrific book about leadership. I give it out as gifts. It's a terrific story. And it was a great movie, too.
Finally, who is your role model?
My father.
Why is that? Tell us about him.
My dad, he passed away a long time ago, back in the early 90s. But I think anything that I've learned of value and how to treat people came from my dad. I remember he owned a car garage and was a mechanic. And I used to go out there in the summer times and work, sweeping the floors. He wouldn't let me get near a wrench. I wasn't very mechanically inclined. But the way he treated his employees, the way he treated his customers really inspired me. He used to say that nobody comes to work wanting to do a bad job. Everybody, you know, when they put their feet on the floor, they want to get up, they want to do the best they can. And if you approach every interaction with every individual every day from that perspective, that they're essentially good and they're trying their best, I think it does color the way you not only perform yourself, but it colors the way that you can lead and manage others.
Well, John Kirby, thank you again for your service, for your family's service to our country. We really appreciate getting a chance to talk with you.
My pleasure. Good to be with you, Alex.
Our thanks to John Kirby. Now to what's happening in California politics and the Republican primary here, which is going to be a big deal in a moment, Sima Mehta. But let's begin with new poll results here in California. Check out this poll of California Republicans. The question, who's your choice for president? Ron DeSantis, the Florida governor, leads with 37%. Donald Trump in second at 29%. Nikki Haley, who just actually jumped into the race, is at 7%. Liz Cheney at 4%. Probably not going to win Liz Cheney. Sima Mehta's team at the LA Times sponsored that poll with UC Berkeley IGS. Sima, welcome back to The Issue Is. Great to see you.
You too. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, so a lot of people here, GOP primary in California, they think that doesn't matter. Who cares? A Republican's never going to win in California. And yes, it's true that a Republican probably isn't going to win the general election, at least anytime soon in California. But this primary really matters. Remind us why.
Absolutely, because even though California is an overwhelmingly Democratic state, it still has more Republican voters than any other state in the nation, millions and millions of them. And California's primary is taking place pretty early next year in March on Super Tuesday. So because there are so many Republican voters in the state, California has the largest delegation at the Republican National Convention, where the Republican Party will nominate their nominee. California will have 169 delegates. So you know, the candidate, you know, assuming that the race is still competitive by March, which it likely will be, the candidate who can sweep up a lot of these delegates in California will have a big edge going into that contest.
which is why we're probably going to see campaign events in California and get to know these candidates a lot. Ron DeSantis sort of starting that process this weekend, heading to the Reagan Library. He's doing a fundraiser. Let's show that poll again. It shows DeSantis leading Trump. What did you make of these results? You're the one who actually wrote the story on this.
I mean, it's really interesting because, you know, we asked a similar question about 6 months ago. And 6 months ago, Trump was leading DeSantis by roughly the same amount that DeSantis is now leading Trump by. Where DeSantis has seen a lot of growth is among college-educated voters, wealthier voters, even among voters who supported Trump in 2020, that he's lost a substantial number of them to DeSantis. So, I mean, there's a couple different explanations. I mean, DeSantis has really been in the news a lot, whether it's his battle with Disney or, you know, he has a new book out. He's, you know, traveling to various blue states, you know, to argue that, you know, my policies in Florida are better.
Do you think that Gavin Newsom promoting Ron DeSantis so much in California has actually helped Ron DeSantis's poll numbers in California?
I mean, I think both of them use each other as a foil because, you know, you know, the two states' policies on issues like the pandemic, abortion, immigration, education, you know, there's big contrast there. But also the two of them seem to sort of like poking at each other. And in fact, like, one of them were interesting exchanges. You know, DeSantis is like talking about, you know, Newsom's hair gel, and Newsom is challenging DeSantis to his debate and saying, I'll bring my hair gel, you bring your hairspray. It's interesting watching the two of them interact.
And they're sort of the next generation, and both of them would probably prefer that Biden and Trump got off the stage so they could be the star now, even though they don't say that publicly. So there is a new poll out about Governor Newsom from Quinnipiac. Let's put that one up on the screen. California voters were asked, should Gavin Newsom run for president? 70% say no. Only 22% say yes.
I mean, I think it reflects a couple of things. You know, people in California, there is a level of frustration about issues like homelessness. And also, I do think among Democrats, there's some concern about how, even if they personally like Governor Newsom, there's some concern about how he'll play in other parts of the country, which are not like California, you know, the Midwest, that kind of thing. So I think, I doubt his team loves seeing these numbers out in public, but I suspect they're not surprised by them, given that they've probably done a bunch of internal polling themselves.
Yeah, and meanwhile, Biden's numbers are up a little bit. It's still not great, but up
well,
some.
I mean, his approval numbers are up a little bit, but what's interesting is the exact same share that approve of him do not want him to run again. And then if you look at Kamala Harris's numbers, you know, California are not really enthusiastic about her running for president either. So, but there's also the question of who else, if it's not going to be him, who else is the candidate who can run, who could, you know, take on Trump or whoever the Republican nominee is.
All right, Seema Mehta and her beautiful artwork. Thank you so much. Great to see you. Our thanks to Seema and to John Kirby, and to you for listening. This week, we've actually got a bonus podcast we hope you'll check out. I drove down to San Diego for USC Dornsife, and we had a great conversation with Todd Gloria, the mayor of San Diego there. So hope you have an opportunity to listen to it in its entirety and learn something about him, the mayor of the second biggest city in California. Thanks for listening to The Issue Is. Hope you'll like us, review us, rate us, send me a message on social media, tell your friends about us, and we'll see you next time for more of The Issue Is.